entertainment, sports, and radio's best guest list. Live from the Zone Radio Studios on Broadway on WZON Z62, WKIT HD3, and at downtownwithrichkimble.com. This is Downtown.
It's the best of Downtown. It's exactly, precisely what it is. Sunday morning, on the 28th day of July, Rich Kimble and Carrie Haskell gathered together in the morning hours to look back at some of our favorite recent conversations. And so glad that you've come along for the ride this morning. We're brought to you today and every afternoon by Cross Insurance, where security meets strength. Well, on the program this time around, we'll talk with actress Dee Wallace, music legend, Rock and Roll Hall of Famer Alice Cooper, and documentary filmmaker Ken Burns. That's what we gathered up for you this morning. Let's get things underway by talking with an actress who's been making films now for nearly four decades. She's racked up over 200 film credits. That's more than any other living actress. You probably know her best for her work in E.T. the Extraterrestrial, or perhaps Cujo. But she's got four new movies coming out in the next few months. Here's our conversation with actress Dee Wallace. Well, congratulations, first of all, on a pretty impressive achievement. 200 film credits. You've been a busy woman.
I have been busy, and I like it that way. But it makes me sound very old, doesn't it?
Well, unless you look at your picture and say, whatever you're doing, it's working for you.
Oh, I tell you, you've got my heart already. Thank you.
Well, you've got a busy year and a lot of things going, and I want to cover some ground here, but can we go back to the beginning of the career? You did a lot of great TV in the early days. There's Streets of San Francisco, which I loved, Starsky and Hutch, Lou Grant, one of my favorite series with David Hartman, Lucas Tanner. You were everywhere in television for a while there.
I did a lot of TV, and I was, for years, I was kind of the queen of movies of the week. You know, that was back when they were all very dramatic, and women were always in peril in one way or another. Now we're FBI agents and presidents and secretaries of state, but back then it was, you know, And I think my vulnerability and my ability to do some good emotional work really opened up all of that for me.
How big a boost was it, and how much did your life, both professionally and personally, change when you teamed up with Steven Spielberg for E.T.?
You know, people ask me how my life changed. I have to say, you know, I was raised in Kansas, and You can take the girl out of Kansas, but you're never going to take Kansas out of the girl, baby. Not the way I was raised. So I was always taught to be very, you know, humble and live in gratitude. So it didn't change my life a lot, but it definitely changed me and the business. You know, people knew me. They trusted me. I had a pedigree then that they could just call and go, gosh, we'd like to offer this to the so it certainly helped in that area a lot.
Was there any sense when you were making that movie that this would become one of those films that generations would embrace forever and ever?
No. And I don't think anybody ever really thinks about that when we're doing a project. We knew we had a special script, obviously a special director. But there's so many things that go in, first of all, to making a hit, the marketing, the timing. Is the public ready for it? You know, are they going to embrace it? And, but it's a whole other thing to consider the fact that you're doing the new Wizard of Oz for the next, you know, 100 generations to come.
And now you also did Cujo, special to us because our station is owned by Stephen King.
Oh, I love Stephen King. I love you, Stephen. that's my favorite movie of everything that I've done. That's my favorite. I think I gave everything I had to that role. And it was a real honor for me to be able to bring her to life.
Well, and that's another film that at the time it did pretty well. It got decent reviews, but it's taken on this whole new life now as a cult classic. It just maybe was ahead of its time. People appreciate it much more now.
Well, that's okay with me. Bring it on. I think the fact that any animal might be harmed, or it's a negative connotation about animals, we're very sensitive to that, you know. And for me, Cujo was always about a mother's love and what a mother would do for her kid. And that's one story I know really well.
We're talking with Dee Wallace here on Downtown. One of my favorite films of yours, and what an amazing cast was assembled for this. You worked with Peter Jackson as well. I love The Frighteners.
Thank you, and it's so underrated. I keep saying they should bring it back out and bring it out at Halloween. I think it would be a hit all over again. I had an amazing time working with Peter and the cast and that. Boy, what some brilliant performances. And that part is exactly, it embodies everything I love to do, that huge emotional arc where she starts out as this simple little victim and ends up to be this, you know, cold-blooded murderer running around with a machine gun, right? So for an actress, it's heaven to get a part like that.
You've also in recent years done some work in daytime drama. We've talked to so many people from Bryan Cranston to John O'Hurley who worked in daytime dramas and said, few things test your mettle as an actor as much as doing that kind of work.
Oh, my God. Scariest thing I've ever done. Literally. Scariest thing I have ever done. I came home the night. Well, actually, I got the script, you know, like the week before, and I called my agent. I said, is there any way I can get out of this? I feel the death. Do you know how many lines there are? And he started laughing. He said, Dee Wallace, you live by being challenged. This is your next challenge. And I was so glad that he counseled me through that, because I grew so much as an actor after doing that.
Well, you've got so much going on right now. By my count here, four films either about to come out, coming out soon, in the works, Await the Dawn, Critters Attack, Three from Hell, and Renovation of the Heart. Let's start with Three from Hell. What was your experience like working with Rob Zombie?
Well, this is the third picture I've done with Rob. I adore him. Not only as a director, but as a person. I think he's a creative genius. And I pretty much any actor that he's ever worked with, if you ask them, they'll just say to you, if Rob calls, I'll go. Because we just have so much fun, a lot of freedom. And so I love working with Rob. Let me tell you, it's probably the ugliest part I've ever done. And every day I go home, I went, oh, my God, you really didn't go that far. You really didn't do that, did you? I can tell Rob Zombie fans, you are not going to be disappointed in this film. It's classic Rob Zombie. Critters Attack, I did for Warner Brothers. It's going to be out. And, oh, Three from Hell will be out in September. Critters Attack will be on Sci-Fi in October. And I got to go to beautiful Cape Town, South Africa to shoot it. Just so stunning there. And we just had a good time. Love Bobby Miller. He's a new director on the horizon, and I think he's going to be around for a long time. Again, really nice guy. Await the Dawn, I don't have a release date yet. We just finished it about a month and a half ago. It's a very interesting script, which is a combination of sci-fi and horror. And it's a different type of material and story than I've ever done. And I got to work with my daughter, Gabrielle Stone. That's the other thing I'm immersed in, by the way, is my daughter's book just came out, Eat, Pray, FML, available on Amazon. And for anybody that's ever been challenged in any way in relationships and getting your power back and knowing who you are, go pick up this book. You will thank me forever.
Well, yeah, I wanted to talk with you about that. You have to be such a proud mom with the work your daughter has done, both as an actor and now a writer.
And a director.
Right.
She just directed me in her second short, and she's getting ready to direct her first feature length. I am beyond proud because she has had a lot of heartbreak for her little 30 years. A lot of heartbreak, especially around male relationships and abandonment. Her daddy died when she was not quite 7. And the love of her life early on was killed in road rage. And then you have to read the book. I mean, I have some of my healing clients call me and they go, oh, my God, we laughed, we cried. I finished it in 2 days. I didn't even sleep. So you're going to love to read, but you're also going to go, my God, how did she ever get through this? And that's the great part of the book, is that it's helping men and women, which we were kind of surprised about. But we've gotten emails from even guys saying, wow, you know, I learned a lot about relationships and what I don't want to do with my lady. And yeah, it's crazy. Crazy when you just write the truth, you know, people find it. Eat, Pray, FML, Gabrielle says. And then Renovation of the Heart is a beautiful little family film that I got to do back in my hometown of Kansas City. And it will be out in January. So, yes, it's been a very, very, very busy year, and I like it that way.
Well, and on top of everything you've done as an actor, you also work as an author, a radio host, a healer, a motivational speaker, and a wonderful website, imdwallace.com. Can you talk a little bit about how people take care of self? And you talk a lot about the importance of that. And is it true that to be in any kind of relationship, whether it's a romantic or friendship, any kind of personal relationship, you have to take care of yourself first and foremost?
You bet. You have to create a loving relationship with yourself. You know, when I teach this, I say to people, who do we want to give everything to? The people we love. And usually we're at the end of that list. And we're just taught. Our parents have been taught that. Our grandparents were taught that. It's not humble. God's not going to love you if you're self-centered, and that's not the kind of love I'm talking about. I'm talking about the kind of love that God has for us, right? And we're made in the image and likeness of, and by golly, we've got to start loving ourselves more, honoring ourselves more, claiming our magnificence so that we are responsible for the creation of our own life. You know, people laugh because I spend half of my life doing horror films and being in fear, and the other half helping people heal from their fears. But it works for me. It all makes sense to me.
Well, I think sometimes our human nature is to feel like, I'm being selfish if I put all this focus on me. But it's hard to give to others if you haven't taken care of yourself first.
You bet. You bet. And to thine own self be true, you know. I would also like to invite people to go on YouTube and watch my TED Talk. Just put in Dee Wallace TED Talk and you'll find it. Because it's all about, people don't realize that the way we see ourselves in the world and the way we see the world seeing us, as our value, that's completed our brain by 7 years old. From conception to 7 years old, we complete that. And so if you want to answer the question of, gosh, I want to do this, but I just can't seem to. Why can't I get myself to take the step, blah, blah, blah. It's because your little child is fighting you, tooth and nail, from the incorrect limiting beliefs that we're given when we're young. And I use a lot of personal examples in this TED Talk. I have a lot of product on my website helping people traverse finding all of these kind of hidden little beliefs. Like, you know, I was raised in Kansas. We were very poor, very religious family, Methodist family. And my grandmother used to say to me, Deanna Lee, you don't need any more than you need. So don't be asking for everything. You just take what you need. And it took me a lot of my adult life to figure out that I really needed to go to Hawaii once a year. So, you know, I think we just have to love and give to ourselves. And the more we do that, the fuller we are to give to everybody else.
It's a great philosophy right there. Dee Wallace, it's such a treat to talk with you. I've been a fan of your work for such a long time and excited to learn more about this other work that you're doing. I love the website. Again, it's imdwallace.com. Watch for those new films coming out. Congratulations on 200 film credits. We look forward to many more. And again, thank you so much for making time for us.
Oh, you bet. Thank you, and have a glorious day.
That's Dee Wallace here on the Best of Downtown on your Sunday morning. When we come back, Alice Cooper returns to downtown.
At Quirk Motor City, you get a huge selection of quality pre-owned vehicles priced to fit any budget. Plus, the Quirk Motor City pre-owned difference with a limited warranty that's 3 times longer than the average dealer's pre-owned warranty. Free main state inspections for the life of the vehicle. A free Carfax vehicle history report. And Quirk Motor City's certified pre-owned 118-point inspection. It's your quality pre-owned car. Find it at Quirk Motor City in Bangor, Belfast, Augusta, and Portland. View our pre-owned inventory online at quirkauto.com.
Since its founding in 1954, Cross Insurance has grown from a small family-owned agency that started in Bangor, Maine, into one of the largest super-regional insurance agencies in New England. With a network of offices throughout New England, Cross Insurance works with top carriers to provide maximum value to you, your family, and your business. We are proud to be the official insurance broker of the New England Patriots and would welcome the chance to provide security for your team. For more information, visit crossinsurance.com. Cross Insurance, where security meets strength.
Pretty sure this should be considered a public service announcement. So in advance, you're welcome. I just went to the Ground Round in Bangor and had the most amazing food from their special menu. First, I got the Reuben Egg Rolls, which is all the flavors of the classic Reuben sandwich wrapped in a crispy egg roll and served with savory garlic smoky paprika sauce that has this slight kick. It's so good. To go with it, I ordered the Memphis Fries, French fries loaded with pulled pork, drizzled with barbecue sauce, topped with chopped pickles and diced onions. If your mouth is watering right now, head to the Ground Round on Audlin Road in Bangor, groundround.com.
Hey, we're back on the Best of Downtown for your Sunday morning. Rich Kimball, Carrie Haskell, and a little of the mellow side of Alice Cooper.
Man got his woman to take his seat. He got the power, oh, she got the need.
Alice brings the old Black Eyes, his back tour, to Rock Row down in Westbrook on Saturday, August 10th. And to talk about that and more, we caught up with Alice again on Downtown just recently. Welcome back. You were on about a year ago with us. Good to have you back.
Yes, thank you very much. You know, you would think that we would start figuring out how to not tour, but that's all we seem to do is tour. If I'm not on with this band, with my band, I'm out with the Hollywood Vampires, and that's... You know, it just goes forever.
Yeah, but you got a brand new tour, and it sounds like you've changed things up for the old Black Eyes Is Back tour. Some deep cuts on this one. You're doing some songs you haven't done in concert for a while.
Yeah, you know, and we really didn't have to sacrifice taking any of the big hits out. I mean, we're doing all the big hits. It's just that we added at least 7 songs that we haven't done in years and years. And so the real fan base is very, very, very happy. And the staging now, the brand new staging, it looks like that funhouse ride at an old carnival. You know, one that when you were a little kid, you didn't want to go on because it was too scary. And that's what the stage looks like. And it's kind of like what the show is like.
Now, will you, without giving too much away, will you keep your head about you in these shows?
Well, I think it's traditional now that Alice doesn't get to keep his head. I think the audience would feel cheated if I walked off that stage without my head, you know. So anyways, yeah, that does happen. But, you know, 50 other things happened before that.
I read a great interview recently, and you were talking about the theatrics, and I thought it was a great explanation. You said it always goes back to the lyrics. It's not just doing theatrics, doing pyrotechnics for the sake of the flash, but it's to tell the story.
It's really all it is, you know, we don't sit and write a script. We just sit there and say, okay, what is the lyric saying here? You know, so if you're saying, you know, welcome to my nightmare, well, you give the audience the nightmare. You know, if you're saying only women bleed, then there should be a reason for that. That would incorporate another actor on stage, usually my wife. And there should be a reason why she's only women bleeds. You know, so, I mean, I look at everything and try to fit the pieces together so that at the end of the show, you kind of go, oh, I get the storyline here. I see what the storyline is.
And you're out there doing it after all these years. But is it safe to say, in many ways, you're in better shape now than you were when you're out there doing those shows maybe in the 70s?
Oh, yeah, for sure. The Nightmare Show and the Billion Dollar Baby Show was ripping tear. I mean, it was like everything that rock and roll was supposed to be, on stage, off stage, backstage, everything. It was the Hollywood version of it, you know. And it's none of us ever thought we'd ever get to 30. You know, 30 was sort of like, yeah, right. Because half of our friends died at 27.
Right.
You know, and so getting past 30 was like, wow, this is really crazy. Not realizing 40 years later, we're still on tour and doing a bigger show now than we're doing then.
What's the old Mickey Mantle line? If I'd known I was going to live so long, I'd have taken better care of myself.
Yeah, I never sit around and ever say, I wish I wouldn't have become an alcoholic, because it shaped a whole new part of my life that I did overcome that, you know, and drugs and the whole thing. The one thing I didn't do is I never cheated on my wife. I mean, that was like, once I was married, I was married. I never got into that whole double standard of, you know, you're married, but you're on the road. You know, to me, that was marriage was marriage. And that's why I've been married 43 years. But in the old days, I mean, drinking, you know, and the party, that just went on forever.
Alice Cooper with us here on Downtown. I saw in the news that the other day when you were playing out in the Cleveland area, you actually stopped into a church and spoke to the parishioners there. And you talked about your marriage and how important that's been, and your faith, and how both of those in many ways have enabled you to be out there and still performing and being at the top of your game.
Yeah, well, Alistair Beggs is an old buddy of ours. He's you know, he was the pastor out there at he's from Scotland. Great, great pastor. I mean, a great speaker. The guy is one of those guys that's just like one of the 10 best pastors in America. And I mean, we went to his house for dinner. We played golf. Did the whole thing. And he said, do you want to come up and talk about Solid Rock Foundation or Solid Rock Charity that you do? And I said, yeah, that'd be great. So we just got up and told him about, you know, we have this place in Phoenix where any teenager can come up and learn any instrument, learn dance, learn singing, learn all this stuff for free. And what it does is it breaks the cycle of the whole, you know, selling drugs on the street, and you know, it breaks that cycle. It gives them something else to do rather than falling into what's available out on the road, you know, on the street. So, but it works. I mean, we've been doing it now for years and years and years, and we see the success, you know.
I also saw huge crowds the other day for Alice Cooper Day at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
Yeah, you know, being in the Hall of Fame was really cool. You know, I mean, we never really thought we'd ever be in it when we started out. Because, you know, the Beatles and the Rolling Stones are in the Hall of Fame, and Jimi Hendrix and all the guys. And, you know, you never look at yourself ever as being in that class, you know. But if you stick around long enough, all of a sudden your name comes up and everybody goes, hey, you know what? Those guys deserve to be in the Hall of Fame. And you're there. So it's very cool. It's like graduating.
You mentioned the Vampires, Hollywood Vampires, with a new album that came out recently, and more original tunes this time around.
Yeah, almost all original tunes. And the album went right to number one in England. It went to number one in about six or seven different countries. So we were just really stoked about that, you know. But it really is an original rock band. We started out doing covers for all of our dead drunk friends. That was the whole idea. And then we decided, well, let's write on the next album. Let's go ahead and write stuff. And everybody loved it. Everybody loved the stuff we were writing. So, after this tour is over, there'll be about a month rest, and then I'll probably go out with the Vampires then for another month or two.
Of course, we air your show on our sister station, WKIT. That's still going great. Are you still having fun with that?
Yeah, I've been doing it 15 years now, you know. And the great thing about it is when I was first approached to doing it, Dick Clark, when he was alive, he says, if you had a show, what would it be? And I said, I would take it back to 1968, 69, 70s FM rock, you know, where the DJ talks about what he wants to talk about, plays what he wants to play, makes it very loose, very, very un-disc jockey-like. And he said, well, let's try that. Well, we're on for 15 years now on about 180 stations around the world. I'm on every night in London. I'm on all over Australia, Canada, Istanbul, of all places. And people just like the fact that one of the critics said, Alice Cooper's show is extremely haphazard. And I went, thank you. That's exactly what I want my show to be, haphazard.
The perfect compliment right there.
Yeah, because I want it to sound like I'm talking to you.
Right.
Not that I'm trying to be a DJ. I want it to sound like I'm talking directly to you, wherever you are.
Last time you were on, we talked a lot about our owner, your friend Stephen King. I don't think I ever asked you what your favorite Stephen King book is.
Oh, that's easy. Salem's Lot, I thought, was one of the greatest vampire stories of all time. And the original one with David Soul.
Yeah.
And it was one of the scariest movies I'd ever seen. I mean, and I've seen every horror movie. But if you look at that movie, there's six or seven scenes in that that are Toby Hooper directed it, and that were really, truly terrifying.
Before we let you go,
Salem's Lot is mine.
All right. Before we let you go, are you getting to play any golf on the tour, or do you you go back home and do that between stops?
Well, I play every day. I play nine holes with my guitar player and my bass player every day on the road. And happy to say that when I turned 71, I said, I'm going to shoot my age sometime this year. Well, about 2 weeks later, I had seven birdies, shot 65.
Wow.
Yeah, seven under par.
Nicely done, sir. Well, congratulations.
My normal game is four over, you know.
Yeah, I'd be more than happy with that, too. It's great to talk with you again. We look forward to the show at the brand new venue here in Maine coming up in August. Good luck on the tour, and as always, thanks for making time for us.
Hey, and say hi to Stephen for me, all right?
Alice Cooper down in Westbrook, Rock Row, on Saturday, August 10th. I know he does this a lot. He's a pro at doing these interviews, but when we've talked to him, just such a down-to-earth guy.
He really seems to be. I would love a chance to just chat with him at some point off record. But he seems like someone you could just sit down and have a great conversation with. We've had a couple of them now.
Yeah,
with him.
Absolutely. Hey, when we come back, speaking of great conversations, Ken Burns comes back to downtown for a sixth time to talk about his newest project, the epic series Country Music, that comes to PBS this fall. That's next on Downtown.
When it comes to your health, early detection is the best protection. That's why the St. Joseph Regional Breast Care Center provides 3D mammography to offer better answers and greater peace of mind, identifying problem areas that a standard mammogram might miss. It provides precise images for all women, including those with dense breast tissue. Call 907-1682 to schedule your 3D mammogram at the St. Joseph Regional Breast Care Center. 3D, providing peace of mind for you, your family, and your loved ones.
Bennett Auto Center is the place to go for full-service auto care. From oil changes to engine jobs, they can handle your every need. Stop in at 24 Thatcher Street in Bangor and talk with the experienced local people at Bennett's. They offer great service, competitive prices on a wide range of tires, and best of all, people you can trust. Visit the website for more information at BennettAutoCenter.com. Give them a call at 947-0351 or drive on in to Bennett Auto Center, 24 Thatcher Street, Bangor.
Well, I got a gal that's sweet to me. She just ain't what she used to be. Just a little high-headed, that's plain to see. Don't get above your raisins. Stay down.
Ricky Skaggs, one of the many legendary country performers who helped tell the story of their music in an epic 8-part, 16-hour production, Country Music, that comes to PBS this fall. Ken Burns directs and put the whole thing together. We had a chance to catch up with him recently and talk about this new project.
Hey, Rich, how are you?
Doing just great. Thank you so much for making time for us, as always.
No, other way around. Thank you.
I've been immersed all 16 hours the last few nights.
16. God bless you. We're all grateful. I'm in a car with Dayton Duncan and Julie Dunphy, my two co-producers. Dayton also wrote the script. And we are traveling down the Central Valley of California on our way to Fresno and Bakersfield to honor, you know, the Maddox brothers and Rose and Buck Owens and Merle Haggard and Dwight Yoakam by going out off the normal beaten path of a promotional tour and doing stuff in Fresno and Bakersfield.
As somebody who teaches history, but my first job was as a country DJ back in the mid-1970s, this was like a homecoming for me, and it was just wonderful. I think of a couple of wonderful quotes that come up in the film. The great Harlan Howard, who says, "Country music is three chords and the truth."
That's the most important one. I didn't mean to interrupt you, Rich, but no. That's the most important one. You know, that's why it's in a central position in the introduction. That says it all.
And then Merle Haggard says, "Country music is about the things we believe that we can't see."
You've done it. You might as well just go write your thing, do your whatever you're going to do with yourself, because you got it. You figured out. You broke the key. And you're talking about stuff in the first 6 minutes of this film. Both of those are exactly right. The line from Harlan Howard that's spoken by the narrator and Merle Haggard, the things that we believe in but can't see.
And yet I understand that the story of country music was more complicated perhaps than you thought it would be when you first began the project.
Can I tell you that there hasn't been a project we've worked on in 40 years that isn't so tremendously more complicated than what we came in believing? You know, what we have to do is shed our biases and our baggage, and more importantly, shed the conventional wisdom we think we have about a particular subject. And it's only by resetting to zero that we then permit these things to happen. And because we never stop researching and we never stop writing, we are permitted to constantly adjust over the many years it takes us that we insist we have to have to do this, to change the film as we learn more and more information about something. And, you know, filmmakers are notorious for not, you know, once a scene is working, is not wanting to touch it. Oh, that's too good. Let's leave it alone. But in fact, we've learned just to sort of sigh and say it's complicated. We have a neon sign in our editing room that says that, and then set about to make that perfect thing even better because of the contradictory, information we have. Roseanne says about her father, Johnny Cash, that, you know, he could hold two contradictory things at the same time and believe in them with a kind of equal force. And so as storytellers and filmmakers know that at the heart of a good story is often that fact that you have to hold two opposing things and not choose either one of them, but understand that the complexities of life, which country music mirrors and reflects so well despite the three chords business, that truth is filled with contradiction and undertow, and that's human life, and that's why country music's so effective.
I thought it was fascinating early in the film when you discuss the origins of the three principal instruments of country music and how that in many ways reflects the diversity of country when you talk about the banjo, the fiddle, and the guitar.
Yep. Well, everything about American music is mongrel, right? There's nothing pure about it. you'll take music that has a kind of homogeneity from a country or a continent, and then you'll do something. You'll mix it with something else, and it will be, you know, great. You know what I'm saying?
Oh, absolutely. The role of radio was also huge in the rise of country music with those the superstations, the WSB in Atlanta, WLS in Chicago with the old Barn Dance, and also WSM in Nashville, of course.
That's exactly right. I think we wouldn't have had country music sort of catch on as quickly and as, you know, so firmly in everyone's heart if there hadn't been radio disseminating it, particularly in the Depression when people couldn't buy a record. They could listen to it for free. And so you would find the one, quote, luxury, I would suggest it's not a luxury, but a necessity in the poorest of families would be a radio that would connect them to the world. I made a film on the early days of radio, and the great radio commentator Norman Corwin said that radio abolished loneliness. Mm. And that's because it may have been possible for you to hear Hank Williams saying, "I'm so lonesome I could cry," and you could cry too, and in those tears you would have a connection to somebody else.
One of the overarching themes in this wonderful film is the role of women, starting with Sarah Carter, and then all the way through to Patsy Cline, Kitty Wells, Patsy Montana, singer-songwriters who were way ahead of their time, like Loretta Lynn and Dolly Parton. Women have always been an incredibly integral part of music.
This was a stunning and unexpected discovery for us too, and that the two foundational folks in country music are arguably, you know, Mother Maybelle and Sarah Carter. Sarah with her voice and Mother Maybelle with her guitar picking, which has influenced everybody else. And all as the list you just gave us, it goes all the way through. And many of the issues and conflicts of today are mirrored in the generations of women who had to, you know, be that much better and avoid that, you know, difficult executive. And all the things we're talking about with Me Too have been there for the beginning. And so we love the fact that Loretta may not call herself a feminist or may not speak about women's liberation, but she's talking about these themes well before anybody in rock or folk is doing. And that's pretty impressive. And so, yeah, that knocked our socks off.
We're talking with Ken Burns here on Downtown. The Carter family, the first family of country music, like so many country artists, their lives in many ways were a country song as well. I didn't know a lot of the background there, but what a fascinating story they are.
You can't believe it. And in fact, they represent the Sunday morning of the early beginnings of country music. They are supposedly about mother and family and the home. And this and Jimmy Rogers is the opposite of this, the Saturday night and the rogue, the scamp, the sort of screwing up, the people for whom, you know, you have to go to church the next morning to sort of reconcile your sins of the previous night. But then, of course, within the story of the Carter family is a melodrama, you know, of incomparable dimensions that sort of belie the outward purity of the story, and that's very human too. And we don't need to judge it, we can just accept it. We've all been through what they've been through, we've all have experienced, or we know people who have experienced what they went through. And then when you get to the story, no one in Hollywood would invent the final chapter, or at least the cementing of Sarah Carter's future. And you know, you and I are not going to give it away to your listeners, but this is about as great a story as you could possibly come. And, oh, by the way, it's in episode 2, you know, and there's many more episodes to come.
Country music in its early days was still largely regional. Can you explain how World War II helped to nationalize country music?
Well, World War II did nationalize it, and that's a really important thing. First of all of American music is a mix. And so when a country mobilizes and goes to war, you do that mix with people. So people from every corner of the country find themselves with people from regions they might never in their lifetime get to meet. And in fact, it's World War II that begins the incredible mobility of Americans who begin to sort of cross-pollinate with everybody else. And so when we think in that superficial, conventional way about what World War II is, the music we always use as the soundtrack to it is the swing music of Benny Goodman and Glenn Miller and that sort of stuff. Mm-hmm. And that was popular. But as popular, if not more popular, was country music and the various songs that were sung. And so we're, you know, Patsy Montana, I'll Wait for You, and Elton Britt, you know, there's the Star Spangled Banner waving somewhere. These are all the songs that everybody heard, and it helped spread. I mean, certainly radio was helping, particularly the stations like WSM with those signals. But this is the beginning of the nationalization of country music, and you're going to come back from World War II, and you're going to stop calling it hillbilly. You're going to eventually stop calling it country and western. You're finally just going to say what it is, country. And by that time, that's true. It's across the country. It doesn't just mean rural, which is, of course, the obvious and literal understanding of it. It came from rural places. But it's so interesting that the story of its extraordinary growth is tied as much to cities as it is to the rural areas from which it sprang.
That's something that I think people may find very, very interesting, especially from the first episode, is how the earliest parts of country music actually sort of came out of the city of Atlanta.
Yeah. So Ralph Peer has been recording race music. That means rhythm and blues. That means Bessie Smith. And he's also doing a lot of ethnic records, you know, Chinese and European, French and Italian and German and Slovakian music. And he wonders whether there might be a market for, you know, this old hill country music, old time hill country music. And of course, there is. And in 1923, he records Fiddlin' John Carson in Atlanta, who's a mill worker who came from the hills. But has been very much urbanized, and he's willing to drop all of the urban, I'm not sure I want to say sophistication, but at least to adopt that hillbilly posture. He adds fiddlin' without the G to his nickname, to his moniker, and that takes it off. And then a few years later, 4 years later, in 1927 in Bristol, Tennessee, just across the street from Bristol, literally across the street from Bristol, Virginia, he records the Carter Family and Jimmy Rogers, and they don't sound anything alike. Jimmy's Saturday Night and the Carter Family, as we discussed, are Sunday Morning, and it's off to the races, and it's going to be, from then on, picking up all different flavors. But what's key in the early days that's not spoken about too much, which our series reflects in every episode, is that there's always an African dimension, African-American dimension to this. You know, the banjos from Africa. Mm. But A.P. Carter travels around with Leslie Riddle. A.P. can remember the words but can't remember the melody, and Riddle can't. You know, the influences of a black artist on Jimmy Rogers and Hank Williams and Bill Monroe and Johnny Cash and everybody, it's all there. So it's always been a mix from the very beginning, and we're thrilled to sort of share this inclusive story. It wouldn't be American music unless it was a melting pot of all sorts of influences, you know, from church music to traveling medicine shows, to minstrelsy, to Tin Pan Alley, to all sorts of things go in to make up what we call country music, but also, I could say, jazz. And also rhythm and blues later on. So they've all got the mix. That's the characteristic of any American form. And, of course, rhythm and blues and country are going to be the parents of rockabilly and therefore rock and roll.
So many great artists are portrayed in this film. But to me, the heroic figure of the story is Johnny Cash, who brought together so many styles, embraced artists from all genres, and could never be anything less than true to himself.
That's exactly right, and I think that he is the polymath, the patriarch of it all, who arcs across our series, because he very conveniently, for us storytellers, marries into the Carter family there at the get-go, there at the Big Bang, and of course it is death that is the last story of our series, and is the bookend of what we're doing. Yes, and I think it has to do with he is the ultimate country person, because he understood that it was never one thing. So he is going to prisons and saying, "You mean something to me." He's going to Native American reservations and saying, "You are not less of a human being than me." He's looking at the poor and the downtrodden. He's speaking to the dark side as well as to the light side. He's including a gospel song in every performance that he does, every one of his television shows at the, you know, against the wishes of the producers, includes a gospel show. He's bringing on new talent. He's reaching into folk. He has a friendship with Bob Dylan. He is the person who is restless and unsatisfied, and he is symbolically represents that energy and that appetite that's been at the heart of country music from the beginning. And that's not then to take away from the Merle Haggards and the Dolly Partons and the Hank Williamses and the Patsy Cline's, but just to say that, you know, he stands out in proud relief as perhaps country's greatest ambassador.
I've read that you've said you're a convert to country music now. Was there one story, one performer that pulled you in? What was it that drew you into this world?
We drink the Kool-Aid on every project we do, but I don't think we've drunk it more fully and with deep satisfaction than we've done here. I knew some. I worked in a record store. My daddy and my granddaddy sang to me what you would call country songs and folk country songs and hill country songs. My people come from the Appalachian Mountains of Virginia, Burnsville, to be precise, still there in Virginia. But it wasn't my music. But when we start a project, we dive into it, into the deep end, and we love it now. And I'm so happy that it's in my life, and I have, as Charlie Pride says in the opening, you know, a song for every mood. Even though one might make you cry, you feel better for crying, he says. And that's the cathartic power of country music is so pervasive and so exciting that I can't wait to share it with the rest of the country. And as we've experienced bringing people into our editing room during the process, the folks that know a lot about it and love it, he'll say, wow, I had no idea that that's why that song was written, or what the circumstances of that person's biography, or how great that songwriter was, or whatever it might be. That there was even something new for the most ardent of country fans. And for those people who say, well, I don't know much, they say, I didn't realize that I did know more than I did, because how wide country music's embrace is. And for those who say, you know, I have a friend of mine, a dear friend, who says, you know, Ken, I've loved all the things you've done, but country music, I don't know. And then he sat down as we had a screening of it, and he was in a puddle at the end, and now all he listens to is country music, and is still abject and apologetic that he could have possibly been, you know, proclaimed any apostasy before that moment. And that's exciting to us. And we hope that, you know, we all understand that somebody might come in with Emmylou Harris or the Outlaw Movement, or maybe from the get-go with Jimmy Rogers or the Carter Family, or certainly no one. If somebody doesn't like Hank Williams, then we can't help you. you know what I mean? Or Johnny or Merle or Dolly or Loretta. These are all the great composers and singer-songwriters of this genre. But we're just so thrilled to be able to share the backstory. This isn't the reading of the telephone book. We'll leave people out that it was painful for us to leave out in order to tell a story that we hope will bring people in and send them, to the music that they want to find out, and send them to the folks that maybe only have a mention here, but they want to know more about. We're so excited that we'll be able to share that with the rest of the country soon.
Ken, the amount of interview footage for a project of this scope must just be massive. Beyond what you use for the actual documentary, how important is it for you and your team to catalog and preserve that information?
That's huge. You know, we've just taken the full interviews, not the edited interviews, the full interviews and their transcripts, 101 people, more than 175 hours, and given it to the Country Music Hall of Fame, so it will be available for scholars and students in the future. But, you know how maple syrup is made. You know, 40 gallons of sap to make 1 gallon of maple syrup. We did 101 interviews, 175 hours. We looked at 100,000 photographs for the 3,300 we have in the final film. We had 1,000 hours of footage that we collected. All of it had to be boiled down to the 16-plus hours of this series. So, our cutting room floor is filled with good stuff and very, very hard choices of what storytelling is about. And so we're thrilled that we are able to suggest in the excellent companion book that Dayton Duncan has written and in the DVD extras that we have, but also in the kind of stories that we initiate and can't completely tell, that people can go and go look up that memoir or go look up that story, or more importantly, just go get that music. And that's what we're very excited about. This is not the last word. We hope this is the first word.
Before we let you go, I did want to ask one quick question about the process, the making of the film. I read a while back that Peter Coyote, who serves again as your narrator and does such a wonderful job, likes to do cold readings. Is that right?
Cold readings. That's exactly right. And he's really good at it. So here's the thing. I'm what's called the scratch narrator. That means from the very first time, after maybe two drafts of the script on paper, I'll read it. And then this becomes a radio play. We're not going to waste the editor's time putting in images. We're just going to kind of listen to it, see the talking heads, but listen to basically look at a black screen until we've worked on it. And so every time we change an to a the, I go in the booth and reread it. It makes no sense to bring Peter in early, right? Mm. So when we're 98% of the way through, then we sort of say, let's bring in Peter. And not only does he read it cold, he doesn't read it the picture either. So we don't care whether he hits the same marks that I did. The editors go back and readjust to him. It's like, you know, a hand-me-down suit, right? I've been wearing it. Then he puts it on and, of course, makes it look much better. But we'll change a cut to fit him. And that's really important to us, that meaning is everything. And Peter brings this extraordinary meaning, and it's often take one or take two. That we're using in most of the stuff. And we're willing to break it up, phrase at a time. We hold these truths from take seven, to be self-evident from take four, that all men are created equal from take one. You know, that's the way we cut this stuff up and choose a narrator in the booth. But with Peter, you can sometimes, he'll read it and we'll look at each other and say, well, will you do it again for the insurance company? You know, just in case we lose this perfect take one. He's great, and he takes the meaning that's there in my imperfect voice and puts it in this great set of pipes and even adds more meaning to it. And we bless him. He's our brother. We've worked with him for decades now, and we can't imagine leaving home without him for most films.
There's a wonderful line by Vince Gill late in the series. He says, all I ever wanted out of music was to be moved, and you have done this.
Hey, Rich. You're killing me. You're killing me. Every single thing that you've brought up is you've gone right to the heart of what it is, whether it was the Harlan Howard quote or what Merle says in the intro or what Vince says in the last episode about moving. That's exactly what it is. The emotional archaeology that has always been at the heart of the work that we've done, uninterested in just excavating dry dates and facts and events, and not interested in the baser emotions of sentimentality and nostalgia, but real deep emotion is what Vince wants, what Wynton Marsalis means when he said this is the art of the invisible, and that art tells the tale of us coming together. It's the connection with others that we feel at that deep emotional level, and that's the heart of our series, and the fact that you found that means that, at least for you, we've done a good job.
Well, our thanks to you, to Dayton, to Julie, and everybody involved in this wonderfully poignant, moving, at times funny, and remarkable series, Country Music, coming to PBS in September. And as always, Ken, thank you for spending some time with us to talk about it.
I'll pass on your compliments to them. They deserve them as much as me. And we're so thrilled to be able to share it with your audience. And thanks again so much, Rich, for watching all of it and for asking such thoughtful questions and getting it.
Ken Burns talking about Country Music, sixth time with us on the show. And I was talking about this with somebody the other day. Ken Burns does not need to be coming on the radio in Bangor, Maine, to talk about every new project he does, but he's done it every time, and he's so generous with his time.
Absolutely. I mean, we had a time that we were supposed to be done, and we asked a question, and then he proceeded to continue the discussion well past the allotted time. He just is very generous with talking about his projects. It's a great time every time we get a chance to talk with him.
Well, as our friend Upton Bell says, don't forget, at heart, he's still a kid from New Hampshire. So there you go. That might explain it right there. Anyway, Ken Burns Country Music premieres September 15th on PBS. Our thanks to Ken. Thanks to Alice Cooper. And thanks to actress Dee Wallace. Well, and thanks to you for making us a part of your weekend. Join us tomorrow. We've got a live downtown. Good stuff tomorrow afternoon. Another legend with us, Mike Love of the Beach Boys. He's got a new album coming out. We'll talk about that and more with him. Ted Berg, the baseball columnist for USA Today, weighs in as we approach the trade deadline. Alan Adams of the Main Edge with movie reviews. We'll talk with Fort Fairfield basketball coach Larry Gardner about a fundraiser they're doing for the Maine Basketball Hall of Fame. And a little more Alice Cooper tomorrow from our first visit with him. A little piece of downtown's greatest hits. A terrific story Alice shared with us about Eddie Van Halen and Glenn Campbell. That's all coming up on Downtown tomorrow afternoon at 4 o'clock. Hope you have a great rest of your Sunday. Thanks for being with us, and we'll catch you tomorrow right here on Z62 Retro Radio. You're gonna